From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a documentary by a Wisconsin native takes a deep dive into the world of dark money in politics.
Later, one school's efforts to hire teachers as diverse as its student body.
So we had all these high-quality people who showed great promise to be phenomenal teachers. And so it just made sense to work to find some way to work with them to help get them certified.
Our On That Note contributor discusses the place of arrangements in classical music.
Plus, a Wisconsin native produces a documentary on some of the first American women to serve in the military.
That was a huge leap. And you have to remember, women didn't even have the right to vote when these women went to war.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Campaign finance laws are often complex and difficult for average people to untangle. Here in Wisconsin, potential campaign finance law violations were at the heart of the so-called John Doe 2 case involving Governor Scott Walker's campaign and outside groups in 2011 and 2012.
A recent documentary aims to demystify the world of campaign finance. Dark Money examines the money spent on political campaigns that is sometimes difficult or even impossible to trace. The film follows John Adams, a Wisconsin native now working as a journalist in Montana, as he tries to determine the impact of the Supreme Court ruling known as Citizens United, especially as it has been felt in Montana.
The film airs nationally on PBS's POV program tonight. Before an August showing in Milwaukee, Dark Money director and producer Kimberly Reed joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and talked more about Dark Money's expanding reach.
You know, these days it's not just political campaigns. We're seeing it just with pushing issues. We're seeing it with pushing judicial nominations. That's something we're seeing at the federal level now. The technique is usually by hiding money coming through a social welfare nonprofit group. There are 501c4 groups that were designed to do things like a neighborhood association that cleans up the park. That's actually what I belong to a 501c4 group that does that in my neighborhood. What they weren't meant to do is to hide millions of dollars that are intended to go into political campaigns or issue campaigns so that they can change people's votes.
Right. And how do you feel that the influence of dark money has changed the moderating role of political parties? Do you think it's attributed to the growth of the, you know, quote, extreme sides on the right or the left?
Absolutely. I mean, what we're seeing is systems that are actually becoming more powerful than the political parties themselves. And as you say, they do tend to moderate each other and sort of swing back and forth, especially these days. But first of all, let me, you know, dark money happens on both the left and the right. So I think we all need to watch out for it. But in the 2014 election cycle, the Koch brothers spent more money than the Republican Party. So when you have two people who are beckoning potential political candidates to, you know, their convention so that they can kiss the ring, when you have individuals, not even two brothers, individuals like Sheldon Adelson, who kind of forced people to run through their own gamut to make sure that these folks are good on issues, it really distorts democracy. It takes power out of the hands of the political parties. It certainly takes power out of the hands of the everyday individuals, and it puts it into the hands of, you know, just a couple wealthy people.
How did Montana become the microcosm for the issue of dark money that drew your attention to it enough to focus Montana in a documentary?
You know, it's a bit of a complicated answer to that, which sort of takes a whole film to answer. I think it's a really interesting answer, but just in broad strokes, Montana has a really interesting history of dealing with corporate influence in politics. As a state that has a lot of natural resources and not very many people there, for its entire history, it's been subject to control from outside money that comes in, wants to develop natural resources, and then wants to leave without cleaning up after the inevitable mess that is created with a lot of that development. And by contending with that and developing, I think, a pretty strong backbone of resistance when it comes to that corporate influence over Montana's politics, you see a pretty strong grassroots pushback against that sort of spending in politics. The other side of that kind of dramatic clash that we saw happening in Montana was the fact that the same group of lawyers who were behind Citizens United started opening up shop, quite literally, in Montana so that they could test the relatively strong campaign finance laws. I think the thinking was, you know, if you could tear down the laws of Montana, you could do it anywhere. So that, you know, it became the tip of the spear for a lot of those legal battles. I'm from Montana. I grew up hearing those stories about the history of the mines in places like Butte, Montana, and seeing that pushback. And I knew those stories, and I kind of figured that clash might happen between this, you know, handful of people who are pushing against Montana's campaign finance laws on one side and grassroots, you know, opposition on the other side. And it just seemed like the lay of the land was right, that there was going to be some drama. And it turns out in retrospect that I called that one right.
You mentioned Montana has a good history of resisting corporations and big money in politics. But for those listeners out there who may not know automatically what kind of strategies and tactics that dark money and money in campaign finance may do, can you touch upon some of the strategies, such as ads or things like that? And what do you think if these strategies are an abuse of free speech?
So the first thing that voters can do to keep an eye out for these tactics is to just follow the source of the funding as much as you can. Now, sometimes that's tough because they're sort of onto the game and usually name an organization something like Americans for Apple Pie, who love America. You know, how could you possibly protest a group that has such lofty aims? But what you can do and what you can encourage your elected officials and, importantly, your local journalists on the ground, what you can do is go to places like followthemoney.org or opensecrets.org and track the spending of these groups to see who's really behind them. Now, the dark money dodge involves all sorts of obfuscation there. So I think that when you see an ad, probably at the last minute, it's probably really negative in tone. It's probably run by an organization with some lofty, patriotic-sounding name. You can probably bet that there's some obfuscation behind it. Sometimes there's confusion between whether an ad is coming from a super PAC or from a dark money group. These days, they're pretty much being used interchangeably. So if you want to anonymize the source of this money, you run it through a 501c4 group, whereas if you don't care about that anonymity, you run it through a super PAC. But when you bounce money back and forth between the two, it launders that money. So the most important thing that people need to do is to make sure that we have disclosure laws on the books in our localities, and that we actually enforce them and we hold our elected officials accountable. If you're a candidate and you're running for office, running on a platform that says that you're not going to take any dark money, that you're not going to take any corporate PAC money, those have been very popular positions, and they've proven to be effective, too, just as a political strategy. So at the end of the day, it does become a First Amendment discussion. It becomes a First Amendment debate about, you know, where is this level of free speech? Folks on the other side of the dark money debate will say that they think that having to disclose who's putting money into these political campaigns is a violation of their free speech rights. I would disagree with that and tend to say that with more money comes more power and more speech. That's just how it works. One of the things we saw in Montana is, like, you know, pretty quickly in a cheap state, right, where the media markets are really affordable, pretty quickly you can buy up every ad in the whole state. I mean, this really is a zero-sum game. Some people do have more speech than others, and if you get there first with more money than others, you just get more speech. And I think that the folks who are pushing for campaign finance reform on a bunch of different angles, some are advocating for, you know, constitutional amendments to overturn Citizens United. Other folks are really kind of pushing at the local level to establish free and clear and transparent elections. But all of that really comes down to a fundamental kind of re-understanding of what the First Amendment does and how it can equalize that political speech.
You've been mentioning Citizens United, which was a U.S. Supreme Court decision made in 2010. And I'm also wondering, there's another Wisconsin connection to campaign finance reform that is debated whether it was very effective or not, was the McCain-Feingold campaign reform law. Do you think that the change really is needing to be bottom-up despite having federal offices dedicated to changing campaign finance reform?
You know, I think we need both. But I think that the urgency that is required because of, I mean, look at the news that just broke a couple of days ago. It all goes back to campaign finance. It all goes back to following the money that's moving into political campaigns. And the news that broke with Michael Cohen and President Trump isn't even starting to touch on the fact that we well may have had foreign money pouring into our presidential campaigns as well. So, yes, we absolutely need enforcement at the federal level. I think that reformers need to keep pushing for that. But I also want to give folks a sense of hope that you can actually have really significant effects at the state and local level, too, because the reality is that with the Supreme Court in place that we have right now, which is essentially the same Supreme Court that voted for Citizens United, that's probably not going to go anywhere anytime quick. So the best way to show that pressure to our elected officials in Washington, D.C., and frankly to the Supreme Court, is to show that the average everyday voter is just demanding that we get our elections back in order, that we know where the money is coming from that's trying to influence this massive amount of political power that we have in American elections.
During a testimony during Dark Money in Montana, one of the lawyers stated, you know, quote, "Do we care enough and are we brave enough?" How do you think this issue of dark money and campaign finance reform can be addressed effectively when, you know, it takes perhaps a national story such as President Trump's former lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen to plead guilty to things like tax evasion, falsifying submissions to a bank, and campaign finance violations? You know, do you think that there needs to be top stories to kind of get the public's attention and keep it on campaign finance reform?
I think those federal stories help to draw attention to how important these campaign finance issues are. There's also a big story that's developing right now about Russian money moving into the NRA's 501c4 group and the extent to which that was influencing elections as well. That's something that I'm keeping my eye on. And, of course, that's what we detail in our film, is how this whole strategy, how this shell game was working in Montana. We were able to really connect all of the dots and show people how this scheme works and what to keep an eye out for. Also, kind of parenthetically, I should also note that there's a chapter about Wisconsin that we have in our film, and I'm afraid it serves as essentially a cautionary tale of what happens when you have dark money that takes root in one wing of government and how that can be really pernicious when it takes over each branch of government and none of the branches are keeping an eye out on the other branches where there's no enforcement whatsoever. That very quickly can allow an entire state's government to slip into the hands of just a moneyed few who are using dark money as their tactic. So, that's a really cautionary tale. So, you know, as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, that's really the role of this film is to show how this scheme works so that we can call people's attention to it and show them how these dots are really connected. Because I think that the average voter is pretty skeptical and fairly suspicious and understands that there's a lot of money in politics. There's a lot of money in anonymous money in politics, and that leads to pretty rampant corruption. And people are, I think, pretty fed up. I mean, if you look at all of the major candidates that were running for office at the presidential level in 2016, they were all, saying pretty much the same thing, that, this system is broken, there's way too much money, it leads to corruption, we need to call it whatever you want, drain the swamp, right? Everybody was kind of pushing that same button, because there's one thing that is clear is that across the political aisle, across the political spectrum, that people are really fed up with the way that we're running our elections and with the influence of money in politics. This is really a bipartisan issue. So what does that mean in, spots like Milwaukee, where our elected officials are pretty much, I think there's a tendency to skew to the left side of the aisle, is like we just have to make sure that we hold those elected officials accountable once they get into office, so that we can actually do something about campaign finance reform instead of just talking about it.
Well, Kimberly Reed, sure. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today about your documentary, Dark Money.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kimberly Reed is the director and producer of the documentary Dark Money. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski. The film screens on PBS's POV television series tonight, and you can find out more at WUWM.com.
Next on the program, it is the second of our two-part series on efforts to diversify the teaching workforce in Milwaukee. That story, When Lake Effect, continues in a moment on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Students of color are more likely to succeed if they have at least one teacher who looks like them. Race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell brought us a story on that issue in last week's Beats Me segment.
In many urban districts like Milwaukee, there is a mismatch between students and teachers. Teachers are mostly white, and students are mostly black and Hispanic.
In part two of our series on diverse teachers, WUWM education reporter Emily Files found that some schools are looking inside their own classrooms to recruit more teachers of color.
Here's a common scenario in Milwaukee schools. You go to a classroom of mostly black students, and their teacher is white, usually a woman. But sometimes there's another adult in the classroom called a paraprofessional or teaching assistant. Chances are that adult is a person of color. Someone like Burgundy May, who leads this kindergarten class in a guessing game. This is May's seventh year as an educational assistant at Charter School Milwaukee College Prep's 38th Street campus.
I think a lot of times as TAs we think like, oh, that's the limit for us.
There are a lot of people like May in Milwaukee schools, TAs who get glowing reviews but don't have the time or money to make the leap to teaching. Rob Rao is the CEO of Milwaukee College Prep.
So we had all these high quality people who showed great promise to be phenomenal teachers. And so it just made sense to find some way to help get them certified.
A couple years ago, MCP and Seton Catholic Schools partnered with Concordia University to create a teacher training program specifically for paraprofessionals. It's called Project Invest. Students get financial aid from Concordia and the school they work for to attend the two-year accelerated program. And instead of having to work as an unpaid student teacher, their jobs as paraprofessionals count toward the student teaching requirement. Burgundy May is in the first Project Invest cohort of about 20 students. She hopes to get her certification next year.
It was something that I never thought was attainable for me, it was like just so far away, and now for it to be so close, it kind of makes me emotional because I'm like really proud of myself and the growth that I made.
CEO Rao says he can't wait to hire the soon-to-be teachers.
We're like drooling. We can't wait. We struggle mightily to fill positions, and so just to have a deeper bench can be fantastic.
That teacher shortage is the main incentive behind programs like this, but they also have potential to make Milwaukee's teacher pool more diverse. Data on teacher demographics are only available for public and charter schools, not private schools. The numbers we do have show a teacher workforce that is overwhelmingly white. But the demographics of paraprofessionals align much more closely with students. 55% of MPS paraprofessionals are Black, compared to 52% of students. There is another new program like Concordia's, but this one is for MPS paraprofessionals interested in special education. It's a collaboration between MPS, MATC, and UWM. Sadiq Isahaku is a dean at MATC who helps oversee the program, which began last year.
It was started as a result of the shortage of special education teachers in MPS, and also the need to find sustainable teachers, teachers who will remain in the system.
The program allows paraprofessionals to earn their degree while working full-time. They also get financial support, partially from a U.S. Department of Education grant. Paraprofessional Lynn Blue says it's about time.
I'm telling you, I'm ready. I am so ready.
Blue has worked at Washington High School for 10 years. She's wanted to be a teacher every one of those years. Now that she's enrolled in this program, that goal is in sight.
That's one of our words too. No, that's not it.
On a recent morning, Blue was sitting with two high schoolers who have disabilities. They were working on basic reading skills.
Late again said the
What kind of, how do you get to school?
Bus, yep. Driver.
Good job. Way to spell it out.
She says, as a teacher, she'll be able to do more of this kind of work.
So I can say, you know what? I taught that kid how to read.
Blue expects to graduate with her UWM degree in 2021. She and others in these programs will help make Milwaukee's teacher workforce a little more representative of the students it serves. And the paraprofessionals who become teachers will have more earning potential. Starting average salary for an MPS paraprofessional is less than $20,000. For a teacher, it's about $42,000. Emily Files, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Coming up on Wednesday, we'll hear more about efforts to create a diverse teacher workforce. Emily will talk with the leaders from MPS's Black and Latino Male Achievement Office and bilingual program. That's Wednesday on Lake Effect.
Contributor Robert Cohen talks about the importance of arrangers in classical music on our next On That Note segment, coming your way after a break on Lake Effect for Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. For many people, if they think about the concept of arrangements in music at all, they often think of it in the folk music world, in which an arranger takes a piece of music from the folk canon and arranges it for a particular instrument. But arrangements have an important place in the classical music universe as well.
Each month, we speak with contributor Robert Cohen about the work of a touring classical musician. It's a feature called On That Note, and for October, Robert talked with Lake Effect's Bonnie North about why arrangements are so important in classical music.
Actually, of course, you can go way back to, you know, Beethoven, who wrote variations on a Mozart theme, for instance. So in a way, that's a kind of arrangement. Of course, it's their own creation. But in a way, of course, it's not as often done as it is in the pop world, or, you know, taking somebody's song and rearranging it, or making new orchestrations for you know, a simple melody. I mean, I always interested, for instance, when I, because I love to listen to, you know, the old great Ella Fitzgerald and Doris Day and, you know, those kind of Frank Sinatra. And sometimes I'm just browsing through recordings and some of them really appeal to me so much more. And it's not just because it's slightly differently sung or it's a different tempo, but the whole orchestration, the whole arrangement of the group is musically creates such a different atmosphere. And then I get so caught up in listening to that particular version that when I listen to Frank Sinatra sing the same song and it wasn't a Nelson Riddle arrangement or something, I kind of think, well, this is okay, but I really love the other one, you know. So it brings to my attention how important the arranger really is in filling the whole space, making the musical experience something quite wonderful.
And it's almost, they're not composing exactly, but in a way they are, because they're taking something and they're creating something new from those pieces. And so a different arranger might arrange those pieces in a different way. So, you know, you're hearing that person's creative input when you hear that arrangement. And like you mentioned Nelson Riddle, I have all of those Ella Fitzgerald songbooks that they recorded in the 1950s, and they are so distinctive. You know, within two notes, that it's a Nelson Riddle version of this, you know, an arrangement of whatever the song standard is. And they are as distinctive in some ways as composers.
Yeah, and if you think about it, the whole of the kind of Hollywood sound from the 1940s onwards was created by, you know, a group of musician, arranger, composers who did the soundtracks for all of those movies and created that luscious, you know, Hollywood sound that you know, kind of marked that entire era and it made it so recognizable that you were watching a Hollywood movie because there was something sensational about the way the music was written and arranged. And they had all those amazing composers, including classical composers, writing for movies. And the arrangers were the people who were creating the kind of identity in a way. I mean, I remember you mentioning about Duke Ellington and how Billy Strayhorn, his arranger, I mean, who was not acknowledged at all by Duke Ellington publicly. And, you know, he wrote, I think, Take the A Train, for instance, mm-hmm. and he composed all sorts of things. But you could attribute a lot of Duke Ellington's kind of type of sound to Billy Strayhorn in a way. I mean, he created... an identity for the group.
Exactly. And you mentioned Hollywood, of course. I was thinking of Korngold and a few other. All of those folks from the 40s and 50s had classical background. They were all classically trained composers and musicians. And so that fed into that sound in a way that would have been different if they had a different kind of musical background.
Yeah, and you know, it reminds me of that story of Horowitz, the great pianist, who decided that, you know, as a classical musician, decided that he was going to try to take T for Two and make an arrangement. And he took his arrangement, so the story goes, to Art Tatum, you know, the possibly the greatest jazz pianist who's ever lived. And he played it to Art Tatum and then said, well, you know, now will you play me your T for Two? And Art Tatum apparently then completely blew him away with his own arrangement, so to speak. And then Horowitz said, well, could I see the music for that? Because I'd really love to be able to play that, you know, that version. And Art Tatum said, well, I just made it up just now. So which was the difference between a classical musician trying to arrange a piece and a jazz musician playing it in that way. I mean, I think that, you know, that's really, it is extraordinary how the jazz sort of understanding of how things, the freedom in it, allows a jazz musician to do what most of us classical musicians really, really struggle to. We're so tied down with analyzing every detail of the score, of the way the composer, we think the composer wants it to play, to be played, that we certainly don't train ourselves to change the notes, change the styles, change the whole feeling of the music, because we just feel like it. I mean, we don't do that really as classical. In fact, you know, I was recently asked to play the cello at a party with some singers who wanted to do some opera arias, and they said, "Oh, could you, you know, play along with us?" And they sent me the music for these famous opera arias, and I was thought, well, how am I going to bring that fantastic opera orchestra down to just me? How can I make this work in any way at all? And so I started to battle how to choose the notes that I felt might be, you know, give some meaning to the music as a background, as an arrangement. And I realized that, you know, I'm really hopeless at this. It's certainly not what I should be doing. I'd need to go to do some serious training if I was going to learn how to arrange for different instrumentation, or, you know, I'd have to go back to school. I really would.
So you're not going to be a Billy Strayhorn to somebody's Duke Ellington?
I'm sadly not. I mean, I have sort of learned to improvise a melody, because a single line I can sort of take a melody that I know and kind of work around that in a way. But to actually organize all the background, all the harmonic things, and to twist and turn and all of that sort of thing, that is such an incredible talent. And actually thinking about those people in Hollywood at the time, one of those people was Andre Previn. He was arranging, composing music for the films and so on. And of course, became a very, very famous classical musician, you know, as conductor of major orchestras and so on, and as a fantastic jazz pianist. And it's another example of somebody who trained in that way, who brought this sort of real sense of how to move music around a melody that can make it really shine.
You know, I find it fascinating that classical music lost that ability, because when you think of the Baroque and you think of what was expected of not just the soloists, but the people who were playing the figured bass and who were expected on the harpsichord to kind of improvise around that, improvisation and sort of arranging on the fly was not something that they were unfamiliar with. In fact, it was expected. And yet that has changed over the last few hundred years, where, like you were saying, you're not trained to do that. You're not expected to do that in a way that, say, Telemann was.
Now, you're so right about this, because now that, you know, the kind of, there's been a much deeper exploration into how Baroque music was played, and how, you know, the thoughts of how that might have happened and what could have happened in that, and how it sounded and what people used to do, and all the research that's gone into that. And now we know that it was very simply the case that even when you were playing a cello Bach suite, a suite by Bach, that each section which has a repeat in it, and the second time you would play it really differently with different ornamentation, maybe different emphasis on different things, but it was expected to do that. And as you say, music with figured bass, that means, you know, just a bass line with the numbers of which explain the chords, and you were expected to work with that. You weren't given all the notes. And we moved so far from that.
Right. I was going to say, that's kind of like the equivalent of chord charts in jazz or rock. It's the same idea. You know, the guitarist is given the chord chart, and it's up to you to figure out how you fit in to all of that. And it's funny how classical music became more codified, and that freedom and expectation of improvisation went away somehow.
And even actually the classical musicians who also play jazz, I must say that when they play classical music, they tend to be very straight with it.
It's like,
And perhaps some of them that aren't get criticized for not being straight. So there's still an attitude, I have to say. And of course, there's some appropriate music. I mean, I don't think if you played Dvorak Cello Concerto that it's appropriate to start inventing things as you go along. I feel that the music has been so beautifully crafted in a certain way that you don't want to stretch it out of its own architecture. Whereas perhaps with the Baroque music, which is simpler, it gives you space for that kind of thing, then maybe that is okay.
Yeah. I was also thinking that one of the ways that classical music kept some of that improvisatory quality is in the cadenza.
Oh, yes, exactly. And, you know, that's funny because I have to occasionally write a cadenza for a concerto. Well, I feel like I want to sometimes.
We probably should explain what a cadenza is for those who don't know.
Yeah, well, it's like a free improvisation of in a section of music. So, for instance, you play the written music for almost like 5 minutes, let's say, for example, and then it's written that the soloist should improvise, should play a cadenza, that meaning that they should take ideas from everything that they've just played, but be alone and now put those ideas into something in a way to show off, really, to show how brilliant you are as an instrumentalist and your musical ideas. And just stretch things like a jazz musician and then bring it back to a point where you would finish your movement with the orchestra. So that cadenza could be completely free improvisation, or as is more traditional, it would be that you write some cadenza. And there have been famous composers who have written cadenzas for other people's music, or instrumentalists who've written their own cadenzas. So they're not improvising it, but now actually it has been composed as a kind of written down improvisation, maybe put it that way.
Yeah, and it's almost like you get a chance to take a solo in a different way, more like the way a jazz musician would take a solo within the architecture of the piece.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yes. Yeah. That sort of thing is not so difficult for me, actually, I have to say. I don't struggle with that so much because I'm actually using somebody else, the composer's material, and I'm making a new puzzle, really, with it, and taking a few experiments in different directions.
Well, Robert, we're looking forward to talking to you more about what you do so well, which is perform music around the world. I am so looking forward to talking to you next month. But in the meantime, thank you so much.
Pleasure, as always, Bonnie. Look forward to speaking to you soon.
Robert Cohen is a world-renowned professional cellist. He joins us each month to talk about the work of a touring classical musician in a segment called On That Note. You can hear previous interviews at WUWM.com.
A Wisconsin native has taken the story of some of the first women to serve in the American military and made it into a documentary. We'll hear about the Hello Girls when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect Now, I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. As we approach the centennial anniversary of Armistice Day, there has been a growing conversation about the impact the First World War had on the U.S. and the world as a whole.
While the U.S. didn't enter the war until 1917, by the time the tensions ceased in 1918, more than 4 million American military personnel had been mobilized, including some of the first women to serve in the U.S. Army.
The Hello Girls were women switchboard operators on the front lines of the war. But although they were in the trenches, their military service wasn't officially recognized for another 7 decades after they returned home.
The women are the subject of a recent documentary by Racine native James Therese. He first learned about the group of switchboard operators from the early 20th century in a decidedly 21st century fashion.
I did a Google search, but not specifically for them.
I did a Google search for World War One. I knew that anniversary was coming up this year, and so I was looking for a story that I wanted to tell in film. So I Googled World War One, and the book, The Hello Girls, America's First Female Soldiers, written by Elizabeth Cobbs, came up in the search, in the top 10 of the Google search. And I looked down, and I said, oh, that's very interesting. And so I got to her author page, and I sent her an email, and it just so happened that in a month, and this was June of last year, in a month she was coming to Washington, D.C. to give a lecture on The Hello Girls. She said, I'd love to be part of your documentary. And that's how it happened.
It is a forgotten bit of history. As someone who, you know, has obviously gone through school, studied a fair amount of American history, I knew nothing about the Hello Girls. And it kind of made me wonder, how did it get buried in the first place?
Yeah, you know, I think you really have to mentally transport yourself 100 years ago. And just the fact that women, these women and other women were starting to get into the workplace, that was a huge leap. And you have to remember, women didn't even have the right to vote when these women went to war. So it was a different time. And, you know, they went over, and I think the women knew that they were doing something that was going to be significant for women. I don't know if they captured all of it, but they wanted to be the best at what they did, and ultimately they were, because I think they realized they were setting the stage. And when they came back, it changed President Wilson's mind about women's suffrage. He was adamantly against it, and when they came back and the other women came back, he realized the world was changing, and he wanted to give them the right to vote.
Yeah. As you mentioned, this was a time in which women were really starting to get into the workplace, and these women were already working for the phone companies here in the U.S., and that was one of the reasons they were chosen to go to the front lines. Why did they bring over women instead of having men who might have already been in the Army controlling the phone boards?
A couple of things. Now, you got to think that they had been at war for 3 years, and when the Americans came in, they were very fresh, and they were using telephone technology over there, but they were just fresh. So there was the English and French women, and then there was the men. Well, General Pershing wasn't happy with either of those two. The men didn't really want to do the job, and they could only connect a call in 60 seconds. Well, the women were trained to connect that call in 10 seconds here in the United States. You know, General Pershing knew that, and the people that were with him were a lot of AT&T officers that came from AT&T, and they crossed over to be Army officers. And they said, we got these women that are all already trained in this. And so General Pershing cabled back to the War Department and said, hey, I need women soldiers. I need them uniformed, and I need them over here.
Oh, and he called them soldiers.
Yes.
Which, of course, came up much later, and we'll get to that in a moment. But how were these women specifically chosen for this job? Out of all the women who are already working in the U.S., how did these women get chosen to become what would become the Hello Girls?
Right. The first call for women was 100 women, and 7,600 women applied for those 100 jobs, which is very interesting in that all of the women volunteered for World War One, and half of the men did. Now, the numbers for the men were much larger, but all of the women volunteered. The first group of women, the first couple of groups, needed to be English and French speakers, so that was a priority. They also, some of them, not all of them, had already worked for AT&T or were already, you know, working for AT&T as telephone operators. And not all, but several of them had college education or were in college at the time. Grace Banker had graduated from Barnard College. So they had kind of those three things. They were a little bit more educated. They spoke English and French. And some had already been working for AT&T.
Now, as you were going through your research, you found a couple of women, at least, who were actually from Wisconsin. Can you tell me a bit about their journeys?
Yeah, very interesting. I think I can tell you, I don't know much about Margaret Hanen, except that she settled in Green Bay. But I can tell you a great story about Hildegard van Brunt. She was born in Paris. She came to the United States, and then she went back to serve in the war as a telephone operator. And so her mother went overseas too, served in the Red Cross. Well, Hildegard, when she came back, just kind of went on with her life and she had married a World War I soldier, and that's why they came back to Milwaukee. So fast forward to her granddaughter. Her granddaughter never knew. She had pictures of her grandmother, but never knew what she had done. She thought, you know, the family story was that she went overseas and worked for the Red Cross. Well, the local reporter, Meg Jones from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, did a story on the Hello Girls and asked to see her grandmother's photo. And sure enough, she had a Hello Girl uniform on and the armband. And that's when she found out what her grandmother really did, that she was a telephone operator in this historic group of 223 women.
So that history had even been lost inside of their family.
It has been lost. It was lost inside of the family. I will even say that when I brought this to the attention of AT&T, it was kind of lost. Their historian knew about it, and they knew a book had recently been written. But within the organization, it was kind of lost that 100 years ago they played such a significant role in World War I, helping us win that war and the Allies.
Well, and the Hello Girls faced a similar fate to many female veterans who would follow them. Specifically, they were told when they came back that they weren't veterans, that they had never been a part of the Army. And it took a very long time for them to get official recognition.
All right. Yeah, well, it took 60 years. And it really comes down to one word, one or two words, the word man and men. So when the Navy wrote their regulations, the Navy and the Marine Corps wrote their regulations, they basically said that any person can serve. They used the word person. So those women who didn't deploy but certainly served a significant role in Navy and Marines here in the States, I think there was about 13,000 of them. After the war, they got veteran status. So Navy and Marine women did. Well, the Army, when it wrote its regulations, the whole regulation is peppered with the word man or men. There is no mention of a person. There is no mention of women. So when they came back, that's what the Army and the government stood by and said, no, you were contractors. But they actually took Army oaths. They wore uniforms. They were subject to military law. But that regulation and the intransigence and not wanting to change that regulation is what held them up for 60 years.
60 years later, how did they finally prove that they were a part of the Army?
So throughout that whole 60-year period, Merle Egan from Montana, she kind of led the fight along with some other women and the National Organization for Women. So during that time, over 50 bills had been introduced in Congress, but never got to the point where they were voted on and just kind of died in the process. And then in the early 70s, a young attorney by the name of Mark Ho, he read an article in Seattle about Merle Egan and her fight to get recognition for these women. And he contacted her, and he was an attorney, and he helped her out. He kind of organized everything. And so he was getting ready to prepare a case against the government to get these women their recognition. But then they found out, along with the National Organization for Women, that Senator Barry Goldwater and Senator Daniel Inouye and Congresswoman Lindy Boggs out of Louisiana were working on legislation to get the World War II women, who were also forgotten by the government, the pilots and stuff. It was working on legislation to get them recognition. And so Mark Ho contacted Senator Goldwater's office and said, hey, here's another group of women from World War I. And so they added their names to the legislation, and then that's how it happened by 1977.
When we look back at the story of the Hello Girls, their fight for recognition, and their service during World War I, what do you think we learn about the U.S. Army?
You know, what we learned is that one, everything has a starting place. You know, when you build and you're standing on people's shoulders, it starts somewhere. And I think it's very important that you find out where that starting place is. I think number two, the Army found out that men and women could work together in close quarters. They were very skeptical of that. They just didn't think that that was possible, that men and women could work together so closely. And they found out, indeed, that they could. And I think the last thing is that when it comes to American citizenship, serving in the military has always been kind of a gateway or a pathway to being recognized as citizens. And that was kind of what the Hello Girls, maybe unintentionally, they kind of did. When they put on the uniform and served overseas in combat, because they were in combat, at least via artillery fire and airplanes, they kind of said to everyone else, look, we are citizens. We want our voice to be heard. And that's also where that started. So I think the Army learned, through the Army, they learned a couple things, but specifically for the Army, they learned that men and women could work together. I did want to mention, very exciting, I don't know if it's opportunity or development, a group of us working alongside with the World War I Centennial Commission here in Washington, D.C., are working with some members of Congress, specifically right now Senator Tester's office, to secure the Congressional Gold Medal for the women.
That is exciting news. Well, thank you so much for joining me here on Lake Effect and telling me about your research.
Thank you so much.
Wisconsin native James Theris is a documentarian. His recent film, The Hello Girls, tells the story of female switchboard operators on the front lines of World War I. We first spoke with him in June. That is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today. And I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.